Hello, and welcome to our program Reader's Digest, brought to you by Owl Radio and the Low Vision Resource Center in San Antonio. I'm John Fisher, and during the next half hour, I'll be reading articles from Reader's Digest here on Owl Radio. First, from the Art of Living, there's a lot of goodness packed into this tangy snack. Here's A Delicious Creation by Laila El Shanawi in Reader's Digest. In the early 17th century's The Tempest, William Shakespeare had King Alonso ask the court jester, "How camest thou in this pickle?" You could say we'd all be in a pickle without the delightfully pungent and tangy food. Today, you'll run into pickles at every turn. Among the array of over-the-top offerings at fairs across the country, including the Fried Pickle Festival in Athens, Georgia, the North Carolina Pickle Festival at Mount Olive, and the famous Picklesburg in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Are pickle-flavored cotton candy, pickle fries, pickle pizza, and pickle lemonade. And the most common food delivery request in 8 Canadian cities, according to a 2021 Uber Eats survey, quote-unquote, extra pickles, please. Pickle mania is nothing new. Thousands of years ago, ancient Mesopotamians in modern-day Syria, Turkey, and Iraq enjoyed cucumbers preserved in vinegar, brought from their native India. But the first mention of pickled vegetables made in salt brine comes 4,500 years before then, from an ancient Chinese manuscript more than 9,000 years old, writes Jan Davison in Pickles, A Global History. The staying power of preserved pickles made them perfect for the long cold winters of European countries like Germany, Hungary, and Poland, where they remain a staple. Pickling involves soaking a food in a solution, usually vinegar or salted water, called brine, to keep bacteria at bay, often with spices like garlic, dill, cloves, and mustard seeds, which are not only flavorful but antimicrobial too. Around the world, many foods are pickled. Sauerkraut and kimchi are fermented in pickled cabbage, while pickled herring is popular in Scandinavia. In India, you'll find spicy pickled unripe mango. From lemons to pork hocks, okra to hard-boiled eggs, someone, somewhere has pickled it. Christopher Columbus typically packed pickled cucumbers, try saying that fast, for long voyages, and the trip to the Americas in the late 15th century was no exception. Not only did pickles keep for months, but since cucumbers are an excellent source of vitamin C, they also helped prevent scurvy. Columbus acquired his pickles from Amerigo Vespucci, an Italian wheeler dealer who sold supplies to seafarers, and yes, for whom the United States of America was named. Though Vespucci didn't quote-unquote discover America any more than Columbus did, early mapmakers incorrectly thought he did. Today, the two most common varieties of pickled cucumbers in North America are kosher pickles, brined with garlic, dill, and spices, first brought to New York City by Jewish immigrants in the 19th century, and so-called bread-and-butter pickles, sweet thanks to brown sugar or syrup in the brine. We have the founder of Heinz to thank for this popularity. At the 1893 Chicago World's Fair, Henry J. Heinz tempted fairgoers with a quote-unquote free gift of a pickle pen if they visited his booth. It worked, attracting massive crowds. Heinz had the market cornered until the 70s when another American company, Vlasic, made ads featuring a stork who delivered pickles instead of babies. Perhaps a daily pickle would do us all good, especially the fermented type, such as kimchi, since it is a source of probiotics and supports gut health. So, in the manner of Shakespeare, take note of this idiom. Either you love pickles, or you're wrong. Next in Reader's Digest, drama in real life. The historic town of Lahaina, Hawaii was burning, overwhelmed by the deadliest wildfire in modern U.S. history. For many, the only escape was to leap into the ocean. From the Washington Post, here's Joshua Pardlow, John Farrell, Brady Dennis, Brianna Sachs, and Joanna Slater with Paradise on Fire in Reader's Digest. Morning. Howling winds, then a brush fire. Lisa Vorpahl, a bank teller, woke to the sound of someone shuffling on her lanai, a Hawaiian-style patio. It was 3 a.m. on Tuesday, August 8, 2023. She looked out her bedroom window along a dry, grassy slope, overlooking her slice of tropical paradise in Lahaina, Hawaii, and realized it was just the wind. Alexa Kasky couldn't sleep either. On the farm where she grew taro and breadfruit for her plant-based restaurant, she listened to gusts that would soon dislodge her garage door and topple the Hong Kong orchid tree outside. Photographer Rachel Zimmerman woke up before dawn in her condo on Front Street, Lahaina's seaside boulevard of restaurants and surf shops, to howls rattling her window screens. If there was any warning on that fitful night that Hawaii was about to endure one of the most horrific and deadly natural disasters in the state's history, it was only the wind. For 2 days, the National Weather Service in Honolulu had been sending out ominous alerts about powerful easterly gusts whipped up by Hurricane Dora passing 500 miles to the south. The gusts hit Maui at a time when much of the tropical island had been parched by severe drought, including the drier leeward side that includes Lahaina. The next time Vorpahl woke up, she smelled smoke. The power was out. A fire had started in the dry grass near her home on Lahaina Luna Road, on a slope just east of the highway that bypasses downtown. Power poles had fallen in the neighborhood and wires had snapped, leading several neighbors to later question whether electrical equipment had started the blaze. Maui County authorities got the first reports of the fire at 6:37 a.m., and not long afterward, police were circulating in Vorpahl's neighborhood, calling on megaphones for people to evacuate. Using a nearby hydrant, firefighters doused the flames. Vorpahl didn't feel panicked. Fires were a regular occurrence. The blaze was small and didn't appear threatening as she and her husband, Eddie Vorpahl, heeding the directive, drove past. "It's Hawaii," she said. "Nobody thought anything of it." They spent a few hours at their daughter's apartment, but returned home after Maui County sent out an alert at 9:55 a.m. that the brush fire was, quote-unquote, 100% contained. It looked that way to Eddie. Nothing was happening. A couple fire engines were there. They were all packing stuff up, he said. It looked 100% fine. Afternoon. Rapid flames, then, quote-unquote, broiling smoke. Lahaina, population 13,200, sits on Maui's western flank, a historic town rimmed by white sand beaches at the foot of the ancient Pu'u Kukui volcano. On most days, it's a postcard-perfect symbol of tropical bliss. But an early morning blaze was ominous, and Mark Steffel, a tile setter, had reason to worry. He lived down the hill on Lahaina Luna Road in a home he'd rebuilt after wildfire burned it down 5 years ago. He had heard that the early morning blaze had been extinguished. At around 2:30 p.m., he heard his wife, Michelle Numbers Steffel, shout, "Oh my God!" The blaze had kicked up again farther down the hillside. Wind dragged the flames toward downtown Lahaina. It was still a few hundred yards away. Mark tried to reassure Michelle that firefighters would handle it, but the speed of its approach was like nothing he had seen. Within minutes, there was a wall of fire 30 yards from the house, he said. Overhead, dry air, the result of a high-pressure system, was jetting over and down the slopes of the volcano, sending ferocious winds into town, spraying gravel and ripping shingles off rooftops. It was a worst-case scenario that some emergency planners had long warned about.
The couple scrambled to gather their dogs and cats. One rescue dog, Poppy, got left behind in the chaos. Mark hit the gas in his truck as flames licked at the side of the house. "I was praying to God that we didn't die," he said. Not far away, on Komomai Street, Anastasia Archangel Pang saw the distant fire marching closer. The Lahaina native lives within a few blocks of her grandmother, mother, and various cousins. They all decided to leave. Pang texted her husband, who had left early that day to work in another town, to see what he wanted her to pack for him. He replied 8 minutes later, but by then her backyard was in flames, and she hastily fled alongside a caravan of relatives. As she drove away with her dogs and a few clothes she had grabbed, she could hear the sound of propane tanks exploding up and down the street, one after another. "When I looked back, all I saw was black smoke," she said. "It was then that I knew, if we come back, we are coming back to nothing." By this time, that same black cloud was starting to smother Lahaina. The town had been the capital of the former Hawaiian kingdom and a trade hub for 19th century whaling ships. Lahaina had the oldest house on Maui, the Baldwin Home Museum, and a treasured banyan tree that has grown in a courtyard by the sea for 150 years. These days, tourists would come to surf, snorkel, sunbathe, and zip line. Caress Carson catered to those visitors at her job at Captain Jack's Island Grill. She had spent nearly two decades in Lahaina and valued its rich history. Mark Twain had visited the Pioneer Inn, which sits just across the street from Captain Jack's. She liked to imagine herself tracing his long-ago footsteps. Even though the power was out, Carson had reported to work that afternoon to help keep the food from spoiling. On the drive in, she passed the home of her boss, Sam, and watched a chunk of his roof as big as her trunk get ripped off by the wind. As she and Sam hauled bags of ice, black smoke started billowing through town. It came on in an instant. All of a sudden, it was starting to barrel over the building, Carson said. It was completely black. You couldn't see an inch in front of you. This was broiling smoke. Zimmerman, the photographer, was also downtown. She grabbed a small safe with her hard drives, her passport, and some cash, plus her computer, some food for her dog, Zia, and a handful of shirts. At 3:30 p.m., already fearing the worst, she snapped a few hasty photos of the rooms, the closets, the furniture. Those would be for the insurance claims. She called her parents in Colorado a half hour later, saying she and her partner, Nicole Nakamura, were stuck in traffic as the fire bore down, and she didn't know whether they would make it out. They encouraged her to stick close to the ocean and to just keep going. Carson was also trying to drive out of Lahaina in her Nissan pickup. Glowing embers showered into her open window, perforating the blanket in the back seat. There was gridlock downtown as panicked people tried to escape and others abandoned their vehicles. Carson watched a couple running barefoot through the street pushing a stroller. She watched person after person run down the side streets until they got to the seawall and then threw themselves into the Pacific Ocean. Carson recorded video on her phone as she drove, searching for a way out. Power lines and palm trees whipped around wildly. She came to a road that was blocked by a downed utility pole. "I don't know if I'm going to make it," she recorded herself saying. "I don't know what I'm going to do. Look at that. That's all burned debris. The fire's getting closer and closer." It was 4:25 p.m. when she saw her friend Kaleo get hit in the head by a piece of debris. "Get in the car," she screamed to him. "Get in my car." The air was black. Carson was disoriented. A light emerged in the sky. "Look at the moon," she told him. It was 4:30 p.m. He told her it was the sun. Evening, fleeing the firestorm. There was no emergency siren, no organized evacuation, few instructions about how to proceed, just a headlong grasp toward survival. Annalise Cochran, who worked for an ocean conservation nonprofit, couldn't get out by car, and the building next to her was on fire. So she ran to the water. She saw her elderly neighbor, Freeman Tang Lung, struggling to walk. Another neighbor, Etina Hengano, was with him. Together, the three climbed over the rocky barrier to get away from the flames. They spent hours in the water and on the rocks, Cochran said, trying to stay away from flying embers and choking smoke. Cars abandoned on Front Street began to explode. Waves of heat and toxic fumes washed over the sea. At times, she said, they began to feel dangerously cold and had to move toward the fire. Cochran watched in horror as people held on to debris and floated away from shore. People still chose just to drift out, she said. By that time, Kevin Foley was stranded in a Safeway supermarket parking lot, flames encroaching on multiple sides. He had been heading to his bartending shift at Marriott's Maui Ocean Club when the smoke forced him off the bus. He walked back to where he had left his bike. Worried about his roommates, Foley tried to ride home, but kept getting blocked. As he moved, he recorded fires all around him. When darkness fell, the sky turned a menacing orange. He watched flaming utility poles spraying showers of embers onto the pavement. He saw the fire consume a three-story apartment building on Kiwi Street. He narrated the conflagration as he traveled, when sparks landed at the base of a palm tree and blossomed into flame. He said, "This is how it starts. One little spark flies to an area, and the next thing you know, it goes up, just like that." Sometime after midnight, a man staggered out from the burning homes toward a Shell gas station. His shorts were smoldering. Skin was peeling from his face. He collapsed on the pavement. Foley encouraged the man to stand and led him toward the Safeway. Foley jumped back onto his bike and rode around looking for help until he found a police officer. Maui police and firefighters had been out throughout the day trying to save lives and help people evacuate, but the fire was overwhelming. The cop couldn't do anything for him, Foley recalled. He just gave him water. Foley and some other people entered the Lahaina Cannery Mall, connected to the supermarket, to try to escape the encroaching smoke and wait out the night. Every so often, Foley would go outside to see whether the building had started to burn. In the dark, cold water off Lahaina on Tuesday night, Cochran and her neighbor Hengano clutched each other, both women shivering and struggling to breathe through the smoke and fumes. Cochran felt as if she was losing consciousness. The women tried to stay awake. They shared stories about their families while also promising each other they would make it together. At one point, Cochran called out to Tam Lung, her elderly neighbor, who was a little farther down the rocky beach, and asked how he was. Tam Lung smiled wanly and made a shaka gesture with his hand, "hang loose," to indicate he was all right. A little later, she saw him slumped against the wall, unmoving. He was dead, most likely, she believes, from the smoke. Sometime around midnight, firefighters rescued Cochran and several dozen other people from the water. She spent the next few nights in shelters. Her body was covered with bruises and lacerations. Her feet and face were burned. "Still," she said, "I feel blessed to be alive." Next from Reader's Digest, from the Department of Wit, all the self-defense you need when some busybody questions your choices. Here's from the book Quietly Hostile, Essays by Samantha Irby. Here's I Like It in Reader's Digest. I don't make a lot of goals because it's embarrassing when you fall short. Drink more water? Can't do it. Go to bed early? but what about my shows? Save more money, but what about buying stuff? Lose weight? Is there a pill for that? And if so, can I take it in cheese like a dog? Eliminate bad habits? What would I be without them? I don't have a lot of coping mechanisms that aren't wholly self-destructive, but here is one good one that I will recommend. Saying I like things that I like. At first blush, that doesn't sound revolutionary. I know, but let's get into it. One of the tools bad people use to make people who are not bad feel bad is the casual dismissal of things good people like. Ooh, that's your coffee order? You're going to that party? Why do you use Vaseline? They say things in a way that makes you feel you have to apologize for liking them. That puts you on the defensive. That sends you down an eternal spiral thinking, why do I like the dumb stuff I like? And questioning your entire life's history of taste and choices, all because you had the nerve to express enjoyment of something mundane. No doubt you've been on the receiving end yourself. The interaction can go something like this. Me. I thought, name of innocuous movie that is perfectly fine, was good. Them, feigning shock. You did? Well, I thought it was sophomoric garbage with no character development and an implausible ending. Seriously, we're talking about a thoroughly enjoyable popcorn movie here. I can't believe you're into it. This is where they stop, a satisfied smugness spreading across their face, and wait expectantly for you to conjure a defense for a movie, or a book, or TV show, or the store where you buy shirts, or the place where you get your cat groomed, or dot dot dot. You didn't make and have no emotional attachment to. Whenever this happens to me, my automatic reaction is to feel shamed, as though I should apologize for not understanding that a thing I enjoyed was offensive to people who actually know what quality is. I get embarrassed for being a person with basic tastes, which then leads to my second-guessing both myself and my interpretation of whatever it is we're talking about. Oh, so what you're saying is that I'm not supposed to think Mission Impossible Fallout is intellectually stimulating and the greatest film of all time? A friend said to me, after using the dry cleaner recommendation she'd asked me 4 weeks ago, that strip mall where you told me to get my pants hemmed is so depressing. I can't believe you go there. I leaned against my open front door in a fraying hoodie and soiled pajama bottoms, blinking at her over my first Diet Coke of the day. I can't believe you go there, she repeated, and it became clear to me that she wanted an explanation, an apology. Unfortunately, I was in no mood to atone for a place that I, and there are 7 bullets here. Number 1, did not conceptualize. Number 2, did not build. Number 3, do not own. Number 4, do not live in. Number 5, do not profit from. Number 6, frequently use with satisfaction. And number 7, told her about as a courtesy because she asked me. Imagine me saying, I'm sorry that the home of Bill's greeting card hut and Lucy's luxury lashes wasn't up to your exacting standards. I would rather live inside the value city next door to Glamour Nails. But I didn't say anything, and she chuckled again, saying, it's so ugly, followed by an anticipative pause. And, I don't know, the smoothie spot is pretty good, and the out-of-business DVD store is oddly comforting to me, so I arranged my face into something resembling cheerfulness and said in my highest octave, I like it. Then I watched as she searched for something to say next, since I'd dodged the trap she'd set and whatever further insults she had prepared to hit me with. I like it, I chirped again. I like it. I like it a lot. I don't remember if I slammed the door in her face or kicked her down my cement steps, but what I do know is that day a new person was born, an upgraded version of myself that no longer felt shamed by some smarty pants making fun of the John Grisham novel poking out of my backpack. We live in a time where everyone is just hurling expectations of justification at each other constantly. I have no idea what news is real or which celebrity is an actual good person or what zeitgeisty show most deserves my attention or which cause is the correct one for me to text my $10 to. But I do know that if I pick the wrong one, someone I don't know very well or maybe don't know at all is going to demand to know why. You can use "I like it," the exclamation point is necessary, anytime some freak questions a regular old thing you enjoy, and it'll swipe their legs out from under them every single time. Deploy it whenever you want, then sit back and watch your judgmental friend splutter and try to choke out a response, because what people like that really want is to show off how much more cultured and evolved they are than you. And saying, "I like it," include the exclamation point, "I mean it," robs them of that opportunity. They want to fight and pick apart the shaky defense you had to come up with on the fly for, I don't know, the place you get coffee from, just because it's close to your house. Let's practice. Why are you listening to Justin Bieber? I like it. I can't believe you drink milk. I like it. Gross, you still use Instagram? I like it. That shirt is so ugly. I like it. You're watching that dumb show again? I like it. Your dog is so naughty. I like it. Ugh, another Samantha Irby book? I like it. And let's conclude this edition of Reader's Digest with some quotable quotes. First, from comedian Leslie Jones on The View, "It's okay to come home and go, I want to quit, as long as you get up the next day and do what you've got to do." From actor Henry Winkler in The Healthy, "You need help, you need advice, you need wisdom, you need the support, you need the joy, and it all comes from one generation to the next." From author Haruki Murakami in Interview Magazine, "My ultimate goal in life is to read books I like, listen to music I enjoy, play with my cats, drink some semi-decent red wine, and watch a live baseball game on TV. Living itself is adventure enough." From entrepreneur Martha Stewart on Today, "When you're through changing, you're through." From former Congresswoman Gabby Giffords, married to former astronaut and current U.S. Senator Mark Kelly, in Esquire magazine, "I was never worried when he went into space, though of the two of us, we never could have predicted that I'd be the one with the more dangerous job." From actor Ryan Gosling, "Just trying is winning." From Quanah Chasing Horse, the model in Allure magazine, "I've realized that to be truly happy, I just need to learn to love myself, not try to change myself so that other people would love me more." From Dua Lipa, singer and songwriter in the New York Times, "The easiest thing you can do is just hide away and not have an opinion about anything." From the former CEO and chair of PepsiCo, Indra Nooyi in Forbes magazine, "If you want to stand out, you'd better be really prepared." And from author Richard Ford in The Guardian, "I don't read for comfort. Comfort I source elsewhere. I read only to learn something and be delighted by it." You have been listening to Reader's Digest on Owl Radio. You can listen to Owl Radio on our specially tuned radio or by streaming on your computer or smartphone. You may also listen at your convenience on our podcast page at owlradio.org. Thank you for listening. This program is replayed after 9 o'clock in the evening. This is John Fisher saying goodbye from Owl Radio and the Low Vision Resource Center in San Antonio.